There we go. So good morning. We are on the phone here at the FCIC with Mark Adelson and Brian Markley. And from the FCIC, we have...
Stephen Mintz.
Landon Strobel.
Greg Feldberg.
Ron Borzakowski in New York.
Kim Schaefer.
Excellent. This is, as you know, Mr. Adelson, you've spoken to us before. You know the role of the FCIC in investigating the crisis. And what we'd like to discuss with you today is some of the work you've published on the history of the ABS and the private label securitization market. We were intrigued in particular by one piece that really caught our attention was your subprime problem, Causes and Lessons, which puts some very interesting historical perspective on this. So if you'd be comfortable answering questions about this and just your experience in these markets, that would be really helpful to us.
Sure. Ron, can I just say one thing for the record before we get started?
Please.
We have a confidentiality agreement with FCIC dated March 30, and you know, consistent with my conversations last week with Susan Baltic and Gary Cohen, we just wanted to make clear on this record that this conversation is subject to that confidentiality agreement and all the protections afforded to S&P and Mr. Adelson thereunder, and we would expressly invoke those protections, not just for this conversation, but the prior conversations with Mr. Adelson and other S&P employees, Scott Mason and Henry Abelescu in particular.
Great. Understood.
Okay. With that, we're happy to go forward.
So one of the things that you describe here in this particular paper, it's the way to start, and it can be a freewheeling conversation from there, is this evolution of an ABS, a home equity ABS market, in the original years driven by the bond insurers taking the credit risk, moving up to CDO buyers, I think you cite 97 and then another break in 2002. And I think what I'd like to understand is in those very early years, what was the specific role? Were they wrapping these securities in a particular way? Were they insuring the underlying? You know, what was the actual role of the insurers in those early years? And then we'll move forward from there.
Okay. The typical role of the bond insurers in you know, the deals from the mid-90s pretty much into the 2000s was to insure the securities.
Were they insuring, so which tranches were they insuring? That's what I'm sort of intrigued by.
Okay. Interesting. In the early deals, there would be a piece of protection for them, and then only one class of securities would get issued, and that would be insured. I think what you're alluding to is maybe how later on there were some deals, recalling one for no particular reason other than I just you know, I'm remembering one particular day in the office, standing in an analyst's office, and it was a deal where there was a security that was subordinate to where the bond insurer started taking loss. So it was there to protect the bond insurer, in fact. And some folks thought those tranches were appealing because they figured the presence of a bond insurer in the deal would give it more discipline and more oversight. And the other side of the coin was that the bond insurers, you know, viewed those subordinate tranches as their shield. You know, they weren't going to be trying to protect those tranches. They were going to let those tranches take losses ahead of them. But that was a much more infrequent structure.
So when you write here that until 97, the vast majority of home equity ABS had used bond insurance for credit enhancement, They're insuring...
Those deals?
Yeah, please.
So those are deals with just one credit tranche.
Which is insured.
Yep.
And pre-97, is there still... So the earliest securitizations, I mean, forgive my ignorance here if we're sounding silly, but the earliest deals, like the first generation of subprime guys in the late 80s, earliest 90s, right, the residuals were all held on the books of the originating firms, generally, was our understanding. Caused them lots of grief because of the accounting scandals involving those and a lot of them blowing up just before 97. So is that part of the, are we talking about the same thing here? So the residuals are held by the insurer, there's a credit tranche that's insured by the bond insurers, and then the top of the deal is structured, is being protected by the subordination?
Yes. No, the top of the deal is protected by a bond insurance, and the bond insurer has some subordination protecting it.
Okay, and who's buying? So who the bond and the bond insurers back then are the same ones I think of today.
Well, yes and no. The the names are changing nowadays, and the fortunes of the bond insurance industry have changed. But back then, the players that you saw in the structured finance market included AMBAC, MBIA, and FGIC, plus FSA, which got merged into Assured Guarantee several years ago, and CatMac got merged into MBIA.
Okay. So moving... So we get through 98, 99 is a tough period for this market, right? So, following LTCM, there's a flight to quality, as we understand. And, you know, there's a small dip in originations and securitization in 2000, which you document in your paper, too. Actually, let's go back. So 96, 97, the bond... Actually, you make the breakpoint 97. So what's actually happening in 97 where you have this, you know, average, it looks like average insurance goes from 75% down to about 40%?
Well, what you had happen was and I think the paper alludes to this, you had the introduction of the senior sub structure for ordinary subprime deals, right? You have to remember that the composition of the bucket, the category, that was called the home equity ABS sector, you know, HEL ABS, HEL, home equity loan ABS, included subprime, which back then was called B and C. It was a very small sector. Second lien loans of two stripes, the closed end seconds and the lines of credit, plus, depending on who was doing the counting, you would sometimes see the small sectors of the mortgage space getting tossed in there. It could be a scratch and dent, could be reperforming, could be liquidating loans, maybe timeshares would get thrown in once in a while instead of being counted in an ABS category. So the differences of counting would depend on whose numbers you took and whether or not they had any category for other. But just with respect to the B and C product, as it was called back then, there really hadn't been an appetite for, or there wasn't perceived to be an appetite for uninsured paper. And then Conti Mortgage came out with some deals. I forget whether it was 97-3 or 97-2. Where they went with a senior sub structure and no bond insurance, and it was reasonably well received, And then many others followed suit and issued that way. So the bond insurance went from covering virtually all of B and C to what, and it went down to where it was, you know, half.
Okay. When does bond insurance, I mean, is bond insurance there all the way from the beginning, from the first Guardian deals in 88? In 89, or the earliest deals were slightly different, and then bond insurance is an early 90s innovation?
Well, bond insurance, I think the bond insurers existed.
In this space.
I don't recall them. I do recall them on some deals in the late 80s and stuff, and there were other players writing insurance. Some of the very oldest mortgage deals, not subprime, used pool policies as a form of credit enhancement. So I think one of the oldest, from 82 or 83, a Norwest mortgage deal, actually used a pool insurance policy from PMI. So the idea of insurance is old. The Guardian deals in particular, as best I recall, didn't use bond insurance, though possibly some did. But that's quite old stuff, and that wasn't really branded as B and C. I think people came to know it was a B and C product, a subprime product, later. But the company didn't have an old reputation as a B and C type of lender like traditional B and C lenders had. You know, back in those days, the BNC lending business had been well established, and people were familiar with names like Household Finance, The Money Store, United Companies Financial Corp, Beneficial Finance, right? Who had the associates, and they had or Champion Mortgage. They had businesses going back, some of them to the 60s. So there had always been that sector to some degree, but I think it's fair to say it came into securitization much more intensely starting in the 90s. I mean, when Guardian and Long Beach Savings were putting out, I mean, in retrospect, securitizing subprime loans, they were quite exceptional for doing so.
So it is the sort of, that's the real early germination of this, is those 88, 89 deals. And then you're starting sort of this first wave of these bond insured structures in about 92 up to this 97 break point where Conti comes out with the senior substructure.
I think your dates aren't exactly right. Guardian and Long Beach were doing deals from 86 onward, I think, maybe 87. It feels older to me than 88. And there were a few other players. I'm thinking Advantacorp. There was a handful. It wasn't a big sector. I do recall I gave a talk at Practicing Law Institute back in the 90s sometime. It must have been around 98, 97. And I included a slide that had a lot of the names of the companies that were gone. Okay, because they hadn't survived because they had booked too much gain on sale that didn't actually come in. I mean, that was what caught those companies. it wasn't a credit problem in the first instance.
It was the accounting of the gain on sale?
Yeah, they had booked lots and lots of gain on sale. That's what the accounting actually required. So it gave them an enormous incentive to use optimistic assumptions in valuing the retained residual.
Mm-hmm.
And the high valuation of the residual would flow through the income statement down to the bottom line, produce very high earnings per share, and very big executive bonuses. So I think one year, Larry Koss, for example, who was the head of GreenTree, gave himself a $130 million bonus.
Back then.
And he was, yeah, back then. And subsequently, there was complaining about it, and he had to give back $30 million. Tough year. he was the best paid of the whole bunch. But I remember one of the they used to call the sector when it got hot specialty lending, because the borrowers were special. They weren't the prime quality. They were special. And there was a magazine called Specialty Lender, and the reporter who covered it was a nice guy named Jim Allen, who's now the director or something of the CFA Institute, actually, down by in Charlottesville. And anyway, that magazine had a list of how much the bosses of the different subprime lenders were paying themselves, and they were definitely in the right business at the right time. But unfortunately, two-thirds of that industry blew up because the earnings they booked didn't come in, and they had been running in a sort of negative cash flow, on a negative cash flow basis. So when they couldn't finance the residuals anymore,
mm-hmm.
they were just dead.
Do you know of any sources for this early history aside from the Archives of Specialty Lender magazine or Inside BNC or things like that?
I have stuff I wrote about it that we can share with you. When people would write about gain on sale, this was the issue for gain on sale accounting. And it produced a distortion in how the companies, something of a distortion in how they behaved, definitely a distortion in how they kept their financials. And you ended up with securities claims from people who felt the stock had been run up improperly, based on overvaluing residuals, which then blew up.
Yeah, I remember there's SEC investigations at that point, presumably because of those shareholder investigations.
Mm-hmm. And what you have is, it's actually kind of sad, because the executives of the companies, I remember observing this at the time, they really thought they were doing great. And we had the experience back when I was at Moody's one time, where the guys from one of the lenders, it might even have been Conti, came in, and the analyst who covered them basically walked them through the facts very slowly, very methodically, and demonstrated to them that they were essentially losing money on every loan they made, and they didn't even know it. So the accounting view of things was a little bit out of sync with the economic reality.
It is sort of
so they left very unhappy, and of course you have lots of instances where the executives of the companies had you know, lots of stock options in their firms that they never exercised, which all became worthless when the companies blew up. Yeah. So there were guys with, you know, options with a strike at 30 and the stock was at 60 and they weren't exercising because they thought, you know, the sky was the limit. And then, you know, just all blew up on them.
A year later. Yeah, I mean, if you have any...
Yeah, so it,
and any source of the detail, either the gain on sale or even sort of the structure of those early deals or the companies, would just be fascinating. And some of it's for academic interest, but it also helps us understand sort of this long, I don't want to say slow, but this long evolution from the earliest deals through the newer structures and to the ones that eventually, you know, were just antecedent to the crisis.
Well, yeah, it sounds like what you want is something that takes in the big picture and pulls it together and doesn't require you to look at it deal by deal. I know that back in those days, Moody's did annual sector write-ups. You know, it was a year in review and an outlook. That would give you some of a flavor of how much there was bond insurance, perhaps. You know, there was descriptions of the issuance trends. There was also, I mean, stuff about the gain on sale. I can find some of that and get that to you. You know, I don't think there was a lot written contemporaneously that really caught that there was going to be a problem from the gain on sale. I think that really came in a little bit after the horse was out of the barn, right? Because there was a lot of accounting discussion around gain on sale, you know, before it happened, and the effects were not what the accounting policymakers envisioned.
No, I'm just thinking about this. It sounds a lot like we keep hearing. This is history repeating itself in just various ways. I'm trying to stay happy about this, but it's interesting. Anything you do have that sort of describes this thing, because, like I said, we've learned. You know, we've been tracking a little bit of the history from the first REMIX in 80, the first CMOs in 83, the REMIX structure, in the beginning of some tranching in 86, and going forward, just trying to understand how these things slowly morphed. The next. So in your chronology, so through 97 and 2002, the bond insurers are still playing a role, but the sub-investors are also there to sort of at least put a check on some credit risk. Do you have a sense who were buying the subordinate tranches, let's say, around the turn of the century, you know, 98, 99, 2000?
Well, players who had, you know, big mortgage portfolios who were inclined to use a little bit of the portfolio to take on more risk. In particular, ones who had been buying subordinate tranches of mainstream deals had a natural basis for thinking about the subordinate tranches of subprime deals. So, you know, outfits like Hyperion, which I'm blanking on what the name used to be, but the PM over there is Michelle Russell Dow. You might even have talked to her, or like Sun America, where it was Simonetta Ranieri was the PM who bought stuff like that. And others, you know, you'd have some insurance company books where they'd be going for the, well, Sun America, where they'd be going for the little boost in yield in the unrestricted part of the portfolio. You'd have some money managers with allocations from, you know, miscellaneous investors who wanted to make a fixed income allocation to structured.
But do you
so
get,
there was, you know,
I mean, you describe this as sort of a very informed investor base, though, a sort of specialized one that had experience in mortgages and in mortgage products and able to understand exactly what they were buying.
Yeah, well, when I say, you know, Michelle Russell and Sam Ranieri, you know, they'd been around the block with mortgage risk. They had bought lots of paper, you know, dealt with servicers for a long time. You know, like staff, at least the mortgage area staff at the bond insurers, you know, they specialize in mortgages, did it for a long time, did a lot of it, knew the nuts and bolts. And because they'd done it a long time, knew the nuts and bolts, you know, they had confidence in themselves.
Was it a slower market back then? One of the things we've heard is that, you know, when you get past 04, 05, 06, everything was just moving fast. You know, so the time to actually study a deal and structure it and figure out the pricing, you know, figure out if the pricing is right for what's being offered, that it was easier to do, let's say, in 2000 or 2001 than it would have been in 06.
Well, yes and no. In the sense that the structured market, you know, always moved fast. Investors in the structured market were always given information late in the game, and the nature of the disclosure materials was that they were so voluminous that real decisions usually had to be made on the basis of sort of summaries, what they would call computational materials and structural term sheets. And those practices go back till before, you know, 2000, whatever. The thing is that despite how fast everything was, you could say that following the rise of CDOs of ABS as another reservoir of demand for the paper, that any real money investor who was going to try and buy bonds felt, you know, pressured to act faster, to respond quicker to an invitation from a dealer to sign up for a new issue, because the paper was getting snapped up so fast. If you were tardy, you got nothing.
So this is the big break, I think, that you also highlight in your paper, which is the CDO is the purchaser of all of the subordinate paper, the BBB paper.
Right.
In 04.
And that's when the discipline starts to go away. Because it didn't take too long after the traditional subordinate buyers and the monolines got pushed to the sidelines that the originators just realized that they could loosen their practices and push weaker product into deals.
So there are two things that happen at the same time, right? The insurers go away, right? This is the big break again in your chart, and the CDOs become the purchaser of the lower tranches,
right?
Well, they're causally connected. Okay, it's not a coincidence.
Can you explain the connection?
Yeah. Having the CDOs come on the scene produced a change in the pricing. The CDOs were more eager and priced the risk more aggressively, which is to say they accepted it for a lower yield. That's in the paper, actually, on one of the charts.
Mm-hmm.
I think one called Home Equity ABS Yield Spreads, etc.
Yep.
So we've been trying to document or illustrate that phenomenon, I guess, in two ways. And one of them is to interview CDO managers and underwriters and ask them, you know, were there other investors for the subordinated MBS tranches? And the other way we're trying to do it is by looking at tons of Moody's data and trying to see where the subordinate tranches go. And we've had moderate success on both, but I guess we have heard a lot of the underwriters and managers say, hey, we always had plenty of demand for all of the parts of the capital structure.
And they did. Once the subordinate tranches started out in 97, they were always able to get them sold. And, you know, though that structure didn't completely displace bond insurance, you know, they coexisted for a number of years, there was always room in the market for subordinate tranches. But that's different from saying that there was so much demand that the pricing moved along. Okay, there's times when a market is hotter and times when a market is cooler. And having the CDOs come on the scene definitely heated up the market for subprime mortgage risk, as shown by the movement in spreads.
So if somebody says, you know, there was a lot of demand for the subordinate tranches outside of CDOs, I mean, would you say maybe that was just a small part of the market, or do you think maybe they don't realize that the ultimate demand really is from a CDO?
Well, it's demand at what price? You know, that you had a lot of interest at LIBOR plus 250, let's say, but at LIBOR plus 100, it's just the CDOs.
But once the subordinate market goes to 100, then there aren't any more mortgage-backed securities with subordinate tranches that sell at 250, right? I mean, wouldn't the 100 the ones put out the 250 ones?
That's the point. Everything is pricing at the tighter levels, and the more discriminating buyers go to the sidelines.
So the CDOs take over. They're driving prices up and spreads down on the lower tranches. What's the effect further up the capital structure on the higher tranches?
Well, it's less pronounced, right? Because the spread starts much tighter to begin with.
Right.
But you do see some effect. I remember seeing AAA, let's say, you know, 5-year tranches moving between 50 and 25 basis points at various times. But it was less about this story than just bigger overall movements of credit spreads. For this part on the subordinate tranches, the triple B risk. The thing that's key, the piece that we didn't talk about yet, was that there wasn't even actually enough real paper being issued to satisfy the demand. Right? This is when doing it synthetically became all the rage. And the amount of synthetic exposures that would be created on certain tranches could be many times more than the size of the tranche.
No doubt. I'm trying to understand the... I'm still behind you a little bit just on the change with the cash CDO becoming the major buyer of the triple B. You said spreads mm-hmm. don't narrow too much on the triple A, but we still have this question of why the bond insurers all leave.
Okay. I'm glad you asked it that way, actually, because there is a step I should highlight. Normally, when we think of the relationship between a cash market and a derivative market, we would think that the derivative draws its price from the cash market, right? So that we have stock, and we expect the options, the puts and calls on the stock to be priced in relation to the price of the stock and its observed volatility. That's not the only way the world has to work, though. Sometimes you get a reverse feedback effect where what's going on with derivatives can start to influence the price on the cash side. And in my view, that's part of the story here, that the derivative side got so excited and bid the price of the risk down to such tight spreads that fed back into the cash market.
And the derivative demand was specifically for the subordinate tranches?
Yes.
So the other way to think about this, if I put on my economist cap, is the synthetics are now competitors with the cash deals. Synthetics have this very aggressive pricing, and that's going to be true. It's going to force the cash deals to have very aggressive pricing on those lower tranches.
Yep.
And then depending on the competition, you know, the level of competition in creating these deals, two things can happen. There's either a little bit more money around to give the AAA investor, or if it's purely competitive, the end mortgage borrower or the originator is going to reap the benefits of all of this. Right? Prices on mortgages are going to come way down, or there's going to be a big fat amount of profit if you're in a new century or something like that.
Yeah, I think I think you hit the nail on the head with the last one. No one was sending more savings to the consumer than the competitive environment required.
Yeah. So if people don't shop aggressively, you price and you just take the YSP and pocket it.
Yeah.
Forgive me. I'm going to sound a little bit like I'm still. The one thing I haven't linked is why the bond insurers just get out of this space, or people are willing to buy the AAA without the wrap anymore.
Well, those are two different questions.
Okay.
Okay. On the first part, the bond insurers, like the traditional mortgage investors, I'll use the word connoisseurs of mortgage risk, and they felt that, well, felt's the wrong word, but they they were would take the risk on at 250 or 350 basis points, but not at 100.
Okay.
Okay. They had more experience. They were used to getting paid more for that risk, and at 100, it didn't seem so attractive.
Can you recommend somebody that we could talk to from this field who would help us with that?
I gave you two names before.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Michelle Russell at Hyperion and Simonetta Ranieri. She's not at, well, Sun America got acquired by someone.
We can try.
Okay. I'm sorry, I missed that.
Yeah.
So it's not profitable for them. They're not willing to write this. That makes sense. Not at the low spread.
It may or may not have been profitable, but they didn't believe it was profitable enough to deploy their capital, to take on risk exposure, etc. Okay, so they back away, mm-hmm. And this backing away is being done by the department that has a long history with mortgage risk. They're mortgage professionals, they're real estate professionals, they're used to reading MBS documents, MBS prospectuses. They're mostly not quants. They're mostly not derivatives people. Okay? It's, you know, mortgage people. It's like a community that they all know each other and trade bonds with each other. They circulate among the different firms when they change jobs. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing he asked about was, actually I'm blanking a second. The first part was why do they back away? The second part was?
Yeah, so I'm just trying to understand, when they back away, they're now people willing to buy the tranches that these guys used to insure.
Well, there's, yes, there are, but different kinds of folks. And what's more, the new kinds of folks coming in are also eager to take on the further exposure synthetically. Okay?
Okay.
So in the first instance, the actual tranches would go mostly to CDOs. And the CDO manager and the CDO investor are not the same kind of folks as who just backed away. They're mostly not mortgage professionals, not real estate professionals. They are derivatives folks. There was a saying that I sometimes heard. In fact, I mean, it's pretty bad to hear it, but it was one of them saying, you know, I'm a specialist on the structure. I don't need to know about the underlying assets and risks because the structure all takes care of that.
That is interesting.
You're saying that was a common refrain?
I don't know if it was a common refrain, but it's you would hear something you'd hear literally something along those lines every so often. And I remember one time, maybe it was 2005 or 2006, I went to the IMN conference at the Roosevelt Hotel, and this was a conference on CDOs, and it was probably, that sounds like the right year, 2005, 2006. You started getting a lot of mortgage paper into the CDOs by that time, and I was on a panel with mostly CDO guys, not mortgage guys, but they were researchers and more more experienced, so they knew the mortgage lingo, and they started talking about some mortgage issues because the I guess chinks had begun to appear. And I said on the panel, I interjected, I said, wait a second, guys, I'm not sure the audience is following us. And I said something to the audience like, okay, just by a show of hands, who's familiar with the term LTV? You know, the loan-to-value ratio, the measure of how much equity coverage there is in a mortgage loan. And pretty much no hands went up in the audience. Maybe it wasn't LTV, maybe it was, you know, debt-to-income ratio or something. But it was a pretty ordinary kind of mortgage term. And we tried that with a couple more terms, and it verified what, you know, I already knew. I guess the other panelists didn't, that the gang in the audience was not really well versed with mortgages and mortgage risk.
So I mean, so were they CDO managers, or were they investment bank guys who arranged CDOs? What did they actually do?
Well, it's all different folks from the CDO industry. I mean, the organizer would have an attendance list.
Mm-hmm.
If I look back far enough, I might have an attendance list. But
if I
was a... I'm sorry.
Yeah, no, sorry. But if we... So what we've heard from some people, at least some of the CDO managers and some of the folks buying this paper were mortgage professionals and had some experience. Is it your sense that they're just going to get drowned out by competitive pressure? As you said before, there's so much money coming through here. The folks that don't know the meaning of LTV or DTI will just bid spreads all the way down?
Yes.
I don't want to put words in your mouth, but I'm trying to just, you know, it's hard to, you know, they didn't all vanish. I mean, I understand there was tremendous experience in the bond insurers and then some of the old purchasers, but they must have still been around, so I'm trying to understand sort of how they get pushed aside.
Hmm. Well, you characterize it as pushed aside, and I think I characterize it as stepped aside.
Point taken. So this is quite, so this, now, does this filter down in the sense that now the spreads get so narrow? Actually, walk me through how this gets from, because I think you alluded to it earlier, back to the originators knowing somehow that they can even put more risk into the pools and march further down the risk curve at that stage of the chain.
Well, I don't have an answer for you on that, you know, how they managed to perceive that the restraints weren't there. But one thing that is very, very clear is that the pattern of deterioration was not linear. Okay? It was slight at first, as evidenced by how rapidly, as evidenced by the difference in the subsequent performance of the successive vintages of loan production. So, early 2005 loans do better than late 2005 loans, which do better than early 2006 loans, which do better than late 2006 loans, which do better than early 2007 loans, and so on. So the change in the quality started out small from one quarter or one half year to the next, and then got bigger. So the, I think it's fair to conclude that the realization that restraints weren't really operating became a more powerful factor and an increasingly powerful factor with the passage of time. In fact, it appears to have, behaved geometrically, in essence.
And the bottleneck all along, if it wasn't for the demand for the subordinate tranches, you couldn't have done these deals. Is that right? In other words, there were enough buyers out there for all the
deal.
So the RMBS deals themselves, right, there were enough buyers for the AAA paper. Is it really the bottleneck is you had to find somebody, in this case the CDOs, and then to take the BBB paper?
It's not. Okay, I think you're on a little bit of a wrong turn there.
Okay.
It's not a question of whether the deals would happen or not. It's a question of what would have been the character of the loans going into the deals, and what would the pricing of the deal have been. You see, there could have been just as well a deal backed by loans to all the same people buying all the same houses, but with a bigger down payment or at a somewhat lower price so that the loans had lower LTVs. Or it could have been loans to the same people buying different houses because their income was actually checked and they couldn't get a loan for more than they could really afford to pay.
I can see this. I mean, the question to some extent, though, is if the pricing of the CDOs gets aggressive and then the RMBS have more money and it filters all the way back down this chain, we marched, I guess the way to say, there may not have been a lot of supply in 2006 with incredibly elevated house prices to make a full doc 20% down loan to a perfectly secure buyer in some sense, right? So I'm not saying, clearly deals may not happen or the pricing would just have been worse. I'm trying to, part of what I'm trying to understand is the trade-off in pricing when I'm on a structuring desk between pricing the triple B's and pricing the higher tranches. Because to some extent, once I have 1,000 mortgages at some weighted average rate coming into the pool, there's a trade-off between the yield I want to give the top and the bottom of the structure.
Yeah, but it was pretty easy to execute all through that time, as the very large growth in the market shows. You were making money on both sides. It was easy enough for desks to move both the senior tranche and the subordinate tranches, and most deals were oversubscribed on both counts.
Except that in these late periods, the character of the buyer for those lower tranches was, as you point out, heavily these other structured vehicles, the CDOs.
Oh, yes, and as I said before, that is reinforced by the fact that they were taking, again, as much exposure synthetically to the same tier of risk.
Now, I find it interesting, because we've heard two stories. You told one story, which is there wasn't even enough paper around, which is what led to the synthetic positions. I think other people have mentioned to us, and you can, if you care to comment on it, that some of this was you could do synthetic deals faster.
Okay, and what do you think that means?
What does it mean for how the crisis evolved, or what does it mean for my pocketbook at the end of the day?
What does it literally mean when someone says to you they could do a synthetic deal faster? Faster for whom? Faster to get what done?
Faster to create the bonds and meet my investor demand and make my clients happy.
Okay, so the theory there is that you had a surfeit of investors clamoring for the paper, and who were those investors?
I
said before, it went a lot into CDOs, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so you could make it to feed the CDO machine, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's what was really getting hyped. And the CDO community was the one, as I said before, that could easily fill a room full of people who didn't know basic mortgage lingo.
Kim, did you have a question at this point?
It seems that you're focused wholly on the, both in terms of mortgages and CDOs, on the mezzanine slices. And did the AAA buyers, I guess you have to take it by step, but did the AAA buyers change?
Not so much. There wasn't. I'm sorry?
I guess you have to separate the AAA buyers of mortgages and the leaving aside the CDOs. So the AAA buyers of mortgages were also accepting looser underwriting standards, different sorts of criteria.
Well, that's a very good point. The buyers at the top of the capital structure, and who never really ventured farther down the credit curve on the mortgage paper, for the most part, didn't study it as hard, didn't focus as hard, because they felt they didn't need to. They had a very, very thick cushion of protection ahead of them.
Landon, you have specific stuff you need to.
And they felt that, modest changes in the quality of the loans shouldn't really be a significant factor to them. And if the changes in loan quality had only been modest, it really wouldn't have been such a big deal for them. But as we discussed before, there was a snowballing where the change started out slight, then got faster and faster and faster, till the late 2006 and 2007 vintages really displayed a very meaningful deterioration in overall quality from what came earlier.
Were there changes of who was buying individual pieces, the equity, the in mortgages?
I'm sorry, could you say that again?
Were there changes in who was buying the equity pieces and the residuals underneath the mezzanine slices in mortgages?
Okay. The answer is really sort of, but not so much. There wasn't much of a market for the real residual. But what many deals did was try and cut the residual into two halves and sell the top half as what was called a NIM security. And it would include a sort of a different combination of exposure to prepayment and credit risk than the other tranches. And they had some following. And sometimes they got bond insurance on them too, the NIM securities. So they would, and sometimes they'd be called securitizing the residual or repackaging the residual. That was done for a while. And there were, so there were some people coming in and buying those. And I couldn't really tell you who they were. But a lot of the residuals and the bottom residual, even when there was a NIM, usually had to stay with the securitizer. So, for example, my firm, where I was at this time, Nomura, had a lot of residuals and had a lot of, work on valuing them and marking them as conditions began to slip. But ultimately, the residuals turned out to be, you know, like nothing there.
So why wasn't, were they just not large enough, or were there too many plates of marking that wasn't enough in the game for that to matter to quality?
I'm sorry, I don't understand the question.
So you said it was your firm and other firms were doing the securitizing who kept these residual pieces. So that's, I'm making the assumption that that's some sort of skin in the game without really understanding the economics of those residuals. If that was just sort of a bonus that everybody thought, oh great, if it turns out to be worth something, great, and if it turns out to be worthless, no problem, I've made enough money, fine. But I guess I'm asking the question of, was the expected value of these security, of these residuals at the time of the securitization, why wasn't that sufficient for the securitizer to care about the quality of what he was securitizing?
Okay. There's a couple of issues there. I don't think it's fair to say that they didn't care at all. But it is fair to say that the trader, you know, in charge of putting the deal together, is taking a relatively short time horizon view. Most important thing for the trader is to book a large P&L on the deal, okay, because that's what's going to flow into his bonus at the end of the year. So he wants to mark the residual at inception with a high mark. And this makes an inherent tension between the trader and the risk management group in how to mark the residual. So out of the chute, the trader is biased to be high, and risk management is biased, you know, it just wants to get it right, presumably. Then time goes by, maybe year end has come and gone, the trader has got his bonus, but now the cash flow on the residual is not what was expected. So risk management might say, we need to mark the position down. Now, this is the mark is going to come out of the trader's P&L for, you know, whatever period that markdown occurs in. So he's not happy about that, and he will try to resist it. Now, he can always prove a mark wrong by selling a position for more than it's marked at. But since he started out being biased to market high, he probably had it marked, you know, on average, higher than he could actually have sold it for. So it's not until risk management puts some pressure on him to mark it down that he's likely to be in a position where he can actually sell it without booking a loss. Okay, so the tendency is to keep them at the inception of the deal and then to carry them at more than you could actually sell them for, and to sell them only when your internal, when either your risk management department or other policies require you to, where it becomes more expensive to hold it, in effect, than to take the loss to your P&L by selling it.
I have to say, this doesn't sound like a good set of incentives.
Well, it's capitalism, you know? It's what we go to war for. You know, you wouldn't want people to start trying to make a loss when they trade things, would you?
No, it could be better than all the alternatives. But that said, you know, Kim's point's an interesting one, which is, right, there's always this argument that somehow, as long as there's some skin in the game, that's going to be the check on quality. And I guess you've outlined two, which was, you know, historically, is whoever was buying the subordinate tranche. And we've discussed at length that the CDO managers did not have that, either the knowledge or the same incentives than their historical predecessors. And now the owners are the people at the very, very bottom of the capital structure, you know, taking the first loss position, the residuals, are also, you know, having aggressive marks on these things. Presumably, if they can get aggressive marks past their risk managers, there's also a lack of a check in that part of the system on what they really are worth.
Well, it's the nature of any kind of trading that when you buy a position, you think it's worth more than what you paid for it. Okay, that's why you bought it. Price is what you pay and value is what you get. Okay, you don't buy unless the condition is true that you think it's attractive. It's worth more than the price you're paying right now. So it's in a trader's DNA that that the real value and the price at which he can execute, you know, are not always going to be perfectly aligned.
But,
right?
No.
And I'm sorry.
No, but I'm thinking, I mean, I fully see your point, but I'm thinking from the point, you know, Kim, maybe get back a little bit to Kim's point. If there's enough money to be made off the structuring of the 99% of the deal, then I'm willing to take potentially a residual worth nothing, and I'll put it on my books, and of course I'll try to get the best mark I can. I'll try to call it, you know, 20 cents or something. And it's my risk management guys that are supposed to be saying, look, you're putting something on our books that's worth nothing.
Well, that would have been okay with everyone but the trader, because the trader is getting evaluated on his P&L, which is what a trader should be evaluated on, right? A trader who makes money is a good trader. A trader who loses money is a lousy trader, right? The catch is how you measure the P&L. You know, how you book things that are, you know, unrealized gains. Right? I think the direction you sounded like you were heading in was basically like you say, well, we're going to pay the trader his bonus with a piece of the residual. So if he bakes the cake, he has to be ready to eat it. And when we say his bonus is going to be $1 million, we give him $1 million worth of residual based on the mark that he put on it.
Right, and in that world, if he made five, you know, if there's really $5 million in P&L from the rest of the structure, then the residual's, you know, really worth zero. You know, he's willing to take it. Otherwise, not.
Well, that's the kind of situation that could really has the potential, anyway, to change behavior. But I thought I heard someone laugh for a minute there. Was that you, Kim?
No, that was...
I was just saying, if he was paid in the residual, then he'd have the opposite incentive, and he'd mark it for less than it's worth. A trader will find a way to game any system that he's given.
Why we love them.
In that respect, I'm cynical as you. I do have another question, I'm afraid, about managers. I did a series of interviews with CDO underwriters, and in different ways, they said, well, you know, the managers were the ones who had mortgage expertise. It was not I, it was not the CDO investors, but the managers often had, you know, in order to market them, they had track records in managing mortgage-related assets, and that's what investors looked at. And if you look at names of, I mean, there absolutely is a diversity of experience, but, you know, there's TCW, there's BlackRock, there's PIMCO. They're from my understanding, they have real mortgage expertise. There may have been others in the marketplace who were CDO managers who, you know, did not know as much, but there's some guys who did.
Okay.
Do you disagree?
I do. I agree. With a couple of caveats. But so the question was about what about those CDO managers that did have folks with mortgage experience? And I said, you know, there's a couple of things going on there. First, though it's certainly true that big names, the ones you mentioned, TCW, PIMCO, BlackRock, obviously have, you know, a lot of know-how when it comes to mortgage stuff. Even so, it's not always the case that their mortgage guys and their CDO guys are so close together, really. Or that the mortgage guys really have a lot of the decision making in the CDO activities. That's one angle. But assume in a lot of the cases they do. Assume the best case. It's also true that you had loads of CDO managers who didn't have lots of mortgage know-how. And this is reflected in the fact that there was a wave of new CDO managers coming into existence through the 2000, I guess it probably peaked in 2006, where you would have, you'd hear statements like, oh, everybody and his uncle now wants to be a CDO manager. And that was an observation voiced repeatedly at several of the industry conferences around those times. The enormous proliferation of CDO managers, because it was very lucrative. There was more CDOs happening. The synthetic proposition meant that folks could get a piece of the action with very little cash up front. In other words, the synthetics encouraged a lot of speculative type behavior. And it was lucrative for the CDO manager to be just to be managing the CDO once it happened. And in fact, the managers had to there's some evidence that managers really had to curry favor with the big investment banks and be willing to take paper from the investment banks, you know, when told to do so, in order to make sure that they would get their deals placed and get the prominence and be there to make money.
Kim, do you have more questions on the sort of securitization chain? Because Landon's got a couple, and I don't want to abuse Mr. Adelson's time this morning.
I actually have two very specific questions that are about mortgages, and one is I was told by someone, and I somewhat doubt this is true, that the CDOs were designed to withstand a 5% drop in housing price appreciation nationally. Do you know what the stresses were of subprime mortgages and whether triple B's or single A's would have run through that stress? My understanding, scuttlebutt, was that S&P's model did not allow for a negative HPA number to be run.
Okay, yeah, that's one that that we hear sometimes. it's not right. The what the old version, what was in use back in those days, and now I'm kind of talking to you as an S&P guy, because you've asked the question about S&P's criteria, and I'm answering your question based on a combination of knowledge I have from before I ever came here, plus what I know from having been involved with the update to our mortgage criteria in my capacity as the chief credit officer. So the old version of levels used a home price shock of a 34.5% drop for the AAA stress. I don't recall off the top of my head whether there was specific lower shocks for the lower rating categories, or if the those would be imputed somewhere between 0 and 34 based on the relative amounts of credit enhancement. The thing that people miss is they say, well, if the model contemplated a drop of 34.5%, then, you know, how come any deal got into trouble, since on nationwide average that's about what happened? And the answer is that you have to connect, in any kind of model, a home price drop to both a default frequency, a propensity of homeowners to default on their loans, and a loss severity on loans that default. And it turns out that because of things that were happening in the that had happened in the 2005-06-07 time frame, that when home prices took a big drop, both the propensity to default and the consequences of default broke from the older historical patterns and were quite a bit worse. But the old model used that 34.5% home price drop.
Thank you. And past history, to answer the question for Moody.
I'm sorry, say again.
Do you know the answer for Moody's as well, given your past experience?
It was, you know, let me just say no on that one. The Moody's system works differently, but I can't say for you the degree to which it embeds a home price drop in its scenarios. It's kind of what they were using at the time, let me put it that way, was called Moody's Mortgage Metrics, which used over 1,000 scenarios and looked at the outcome over all of those scenarios, and some of them were bad scenarios. And what I can tell you is, in the bad scenarios, how bad was the home price drop, or how many of the scenarios were bad scenarios? So how influential was that in their analysis? That's what I can't say. That's what I don't know to say.
Thank you.
In the last couple of minutes, I think Landon has some questions also, sort of historical questions, then we'll circle to any other loose ends that we need to tie up, if you don't mind.
Hi, this is Landon. I was just hoping to ask Mr. Adelson about mortgage securitization funding. I should say the pipeline funding. In the early 2000s, quite a bit of it shifted towards commercial paper conduits. And then after 2005, quite a bit more shifted towards the repo market. I was curious if you could characterize the funding of securitization pipelines in the 90s and then the 2000s and contrast those two, and then tell me a little about what you thought of the transition towards short-term funding.
Well, it's always been short-term funding for the securitization pipeline, and this has this isn't peculiar to the subprime area or anything. It pertains just as much to the origination of plain old boring prime quality conforming loans that would go to Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac. Mortgage originators have to finance the pipeline that they're always trying to sell on a forward basis, and whether that entails having a revolving line from a big commercial bank or from an investment bank, and investment banks liked to do it because that was a way to entice the customer to give you the underwriting business. It was an alternative to actually buying the loans from the customer. I'm saying customer is the originator. There's always a short-term funding orientation on the mortgage origination pipeline. And the desire to use asset-backed commercial paper for this goes back to the early 90s, and there were challenges then. I think the expansiveness of asset-backed CP liquidity facilities got a little bigger. I think the thinking about you know, the idea of credit risk over a very short horizon became sharper as time went by, because it is, or had been traditionally, an extremely low-risk proposition. The risk was that, well, wasn't that the loan itself would default or go bad or something, but rather that it would be rejected on delivery because of some technical defect. You know, the documents hadn't been notarized, or something was missing from the file, and therefore it was rejected on delivery. And then you wouldn't get your money back if you were the lender who financed that warehouse, because the originator didn't get his money for the loan. You know, he had to have the money in his pocket to pay you. So moving it to asset-backed CP or to a repo is just a natural transition, as those devices for short-term financing became more prevalent and bigger. Repo facilities and asset-backed CP grew to provide just more of the short-term financing for pretty much every kind of thing than they had before.
So is it fair to characterize that in the 90s, the predominant source of this funding was these commercial and investment banks?
That's my impression. I think it was between, let's say, 93 and 98 when the CP came online in a meaningful way. And I think whole loan repos, you know what, I couldn't really tell you when that got going. I have memories of whole loan repos going back to the 80s, but just a little bit. So I don't have a good feel for relative volume.
Mm-hmm.
But all the tools of short-term financing are going to be in play. And anyone who's doing the job right is always going to be comparing his options for financing his production pipeline. Because if he can knock a couple basis points off of that financing, it's going to fall right to his bottom line.
I want to say that in 2005 or 2006, CP mortgage warehouse facilities were approximately $50 or $60 billion. How much of the total securitization funding pipeline would you guess that is?
I don't know.
Do you see any problem, given some of the frailties we've seen in short-term funding markets? Do you see any problem using these markets to fund securitization pipelines?
No, that's not so much an issue. What we're talking about on mortgages is for the most part 30-year legal final paper that tends to show an average maturity of 5, 7, 10 years, something like that. And in the big picture proposition of, do you create mortgage loans or not, or do you provide housing finance or not, an incremental cost in financing 45 days of holding period at the inception of the loan is not going to really tip a balance too, meaningfully.
I just meant in terms of how quickly some of those funding markets contracted and left a lot of those companies short of funding.
Okay. That's a different question. And I think what that question is a company well managed if its operations guy or its treasurer doesn't have a fallback? If he allows himself to have only one source of funding his pipeline. Okay?
Okay.
And if that's the question, then the answer is, well, that's a guy who's really exposing himself. Because if that source dries up, he's got a real problem. And his borrowers, who haven't closed their loans yet, may have a real problem.
Great, thank you.
So Steve had to walk out. He just wanted me to clarify one thing. I guess you'd mentioned this. It gets a little bit back to the question of S&P and the models. There were people here that, and I think you may have answered this in the first interview, so forgive us if we ask again. The extent to which, what level of loan detail was used on the rating of RMBS? Was it simply the aggregates, or was it the loan by loan data from the loan tapes back in that period?
Okay, both. All the big rating agencies used loan-by-loan data for rating U.S. residential mortgage loans.
Okay, so the inputs into the model are the loan-level data.
Yes.
Because I've seen some, you know, rating memoranda and the like where each loan is scored roughly to some level of risk, and then it's that aggregate risk that's then put through the stresses. Is that a fair characterization?
Well, in the S&P system, the way it worked was the system collected several dozen different data fields per loan, and then would bucket the loans into I think it was 10 risk grades, RG1 through RG10, and then run from there. So there was an intermediate step of bucketing, but the bucketing process used all the data.
Okay. Yeah, that jives with my prior, and that's very helpful. Anything else, Lynn? Kim, you good? We may have lost Kim.
I guess just one thing from my side. You know, Brian had mentioned to me that you might have wanted to talk about the paper called Risk Management Lessons from the Subprime Problem.
I believe I've read that one, but it wasn't on my agenda for today.
Okay.
But I should give you this opportunity. Is there anything that we've discussed today, or anything in general that you think the commission, as it completes its work and gets ready to issue its report, really needs to examine or to understand, and that's vital in a way that we really need to focus on?
Well, I'll give you just two minutes of thoughts about that. I think that you know, you're focused on a lot of details here, and that's really good, because you know the devil is always in the details. But I also think it's fair to step back and ask some of the really big picture kinds of questions. And in that vein, I think it's, you know, a couple of those questions would be, what do we Americans, you know, want from our financial system? Okay? You know, why do we have a financial system? Because I think we will be better off if we have an answer to that question that can then guide the process of framing policy about how to regulate the financial system to help America get what we want out of it. So I think that's a fair question to take up, and I can hardly think of a better body than the commission to do it. In a similar vein, I think if you're going to zero in on banks, let's say, I think one of the big picture questions you might want to ask is, how do we want banks to think about how they manage risk, how they take risk? Do we care? And if we do care, you know, what are we really looking for there? The first time I spoke with your colleagues, I said, and it was right before you were going to talk with the heads of the banks, I encourage you to ask them, how did they decide how much risk to take? And I think the problem may have been that they didn't really think about it so hard. So that's my, you know, 90 seconds and 2 cents worth.
There's
and I hope it... I said that's 90 seconds and 2 cents worth, and I hope it helps, but I know you guys have a lot of wood to chop, so I'm not going to hold my breath that that'll be the stuff that becomes the most important in your thinking.
I think some of these are high on our list, I will tell you. Is there a particular trade-off, though, when you say what system, what financial system Americans want? Are there two or three things you in particular that you see needing to trade off in making that decision?
Well, yeah, it's a political question, and it has to be, you know, debated in Congress and hopefully decided. Do we want a financial system for the purpose of making sure that American families and businesses get ordinary financial services, checking accounts, savings accounts, stock brokerage accounts, whatever? Or do we want to have a financial system, and this is, you know, more likely true, that also helps capitalism function in our economy, that that works to, you know, allow the invisible hand to move society's scarce productive resources from their less productive uses to their more productive uses? Or do we want yet something even more from our financial system, like maybe being an export industry where we provide financial services to foreigners who pay us and it helps our balance of trade? And therefore, we want to make sure it's very competitive and can offer the same wide array of products and services that the you know, foreign financial systems might do. And those three different potential answers of what you want can guide you to very different conclusions about how big you want the financial sector to be in the economy, and the range of activities you want to grant it a license to engage in. Because I think everyone understands the financial firms are going to be regulated. Okay, any kind of business that starts with the proposition, give us your money and we'll hold on to it for you, will attract the wrong element if it's not at all regulated.
I like that characterization. So this is, we could talk for a very long time, but it's unfortunate we have to stop here because I think the big picture questions would be very, very interesting. But you've been very, very generous with your time this morning. I know the Commission has spoken to you now on two or possibly three occasions. We are grateful, and we're grateful for the insight and for the historical perspective you were able to give us today. Many thanks.
Thank you.
Glad to help.
Take care now. Thank you, Brian.
Okay.
Bye.